Welcome back, listeners. If you're hearing this, you made it through another week. Congratulations. Not everyone can say the same. Tonight's episode isn't about ghosts or demons or things that hide in the shadows. Tonight is about something far more terrifying: the human will to survive, and the unspeakable things we become when that will is tested. So turn off the lights, lock your doors, and whatever you do, don't think too hard about what you would do in their position. Because once you start down that road, there's no coming back. Let's begin. Story 1. I've been working at Secure Space Storage in Bangalore for about 3 years now. It's not glamorous, but it pays the bills. Most days, I just sit at the front desk, sign people in, and occasionally help them move boxes. Pretty straightforward, you know. Last month, my manager, Mr. Sharma, called me into his office. "Arjun, I need you to clean out Unit 213, he said, not meeting my eyes. "The one in the basement level?" He nodded. "Rent hasn't been paid in 6 months. We need to clear it out. Inventory everything, the usual procedure." Something about his tone felt off, but I didn't push it. I mean, it was just another abandoned unit, right? The basement level always creeped me out a bit. The fluorescent lights buzzed constantly, and there was this weird echo that made every footstep sound like someone was following you. Unit 213 was at the very end of the corridor, naturally. I unlocked the heavy metal door and pulled it up with a groan. The smell hit me first. Stale air, like the unit had been sealed for years instead of months. I flipped on my flashlight, expecting the usual chaos of forgotten belongings. But Unit 213 was empty, completely empty, except for two things sitting in the exact center of the concrete floor. A simple wooden chair facing the door, and a video camera on a tripod pointing at the chair. The red recording light was still blinking. "That's weird," I muttered, my voice echoing in the empty space. Looking back, I should have just grabbed the stuff and left. But curiosity got the better of me. The camera was an older model, the kind that records onto SD cards. I checked the battery, somehow still at 40%. I didn't want to seem paranoid, but my hands were shaking slightly as I ejected the card and pulled out my phone to check the footage. The file directory showed hundreds of video files, dated back over 6 months. Each one was exactly 8 hours long, time-stamped from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. I opened the most recent file from last night. For the first few hours, it was just what you'd expect. An empty chair in an empty room, the timestamp ticking forward in the corner. I fast-forwarded, watching the numbers blur. 11:47 p.m., 12:15 a.m., 1:08 a.m., nothing. Just the chair and the bare concrete walls. Then at 3:33 a.m., someone was sitting in the chair. I felt my heart drop. I hadn't seen them appear. One frame, the chair was empty. The next frame, someone was there, perfectly still, staring directly at the camera. I couldn't make out their face clearly. The image was grainy, but their posture was wrong somehow. Too rigid, too still. They sat there for exactly 3 minutes, not moving, not blinking as far as I could tell. At 3:36 a.m., the chair was empty again. Maybe I was just paranoid, but I checked another file. Same thing. 3:33 a.m., someone in the chair. 3 minutes, gone. I went back weeks, every single night. Same time, same 3 minutes. "This is insane," I whispered. I called Mr. Sharma. "Sir, did you know there was a camera in Unit 213? A long pause. "Just clear it out, Arjun, today." "But there's footage of..." He hung up. I should have left right then. Instead, I checked the previous night's footage one more time. And that's when I noticed something I'd missed. In the reflection on the camera lens, barely visible, I could see the unit door. It was closed, locked from the inside. Whoever was sitting in that chair every night was locking themselves in. I heard a sound behind me, a soft scraping like wood dragging across concrete. I spun around. The chair had moved. I know it had. It was facing a different direction now, angled slightly toward me instead of the door. My phone buzzed. A message from an unknown number. 3:33. I looked at the time. 3:31 p.m. No, no, no. I backed toward the door, my legs feeling like lead. The temperature in the unit had dropped. I could see my breath. The camera's red light blinked faster. 3:32 p.m. I grabbed the chair and the tripod, my hands fumbling. I didn't care about protocol anymore. I just wanted out. The camera slipped, and as I caught it, the viewfinder flipped on, showing me the live feed. In the small screen, I saw myself, panicked, gathering the equipment. And behind me, in the corner of the unit that I knew was empty, the viewfinder showed a figure standing perfectly still, watching me. I didn't look back. I ran. I left everything in the corridor and took the stairs two at a time. When I reached the ground floor, I went straight to Mr. Sharma's office and quit on the spot. He just nodded, like he'd been expecting it. "You're the fifth person I've sent down there," he said quietly. "You lasted the longest." I moved back to Mumbai 2 weeks later, got a job at a call center. Better pay, actually. But to this day, I still can't look at empty chairs the same way. And I never, ever check the time at 3:33 morning or afternoon. Sometimes, late at night. I wonder who's sitting in that chair right now, staring at a camera in an empty unit. And worse, I wonder if they're still watching the footage, if they know who I am. Just last week, I found a wooden chair in the hallway outside my apartment. It was facing my door. I moved it to the building's storage room. But honestly, I'm thinking about moving again. Story 2. I found the place on a Tuesday in October. Basement flat in Archway. Zone 2, £850 a month. Basically, a miracle for London. I'm a copywriter, 26, and I'd been sleeping on my mate's sofa for 3 months. When the landlord, Mr. Pemberton, showed me around, I didn't ask too many questions. I mean, it was dark, obviously, being underground and all, but it had a bedroom, a tiny kitchen, and the Wi-Fi worked. I signed the lease that afternoon. The footsteps started on my fourth night there. At first, I thought I was imagining it. You know how old buildings settle, especially Victorian conversions like this one. Around 2 a.m., I'd hear the soft thud, thud, thud beneath my bedroom floor. Slow, deliberate steps, then nothing. I'd lie there in the dark, holding my breath, waiting, but it wouldn't come back. Probably just pipes, I told myself, or rats, big rats. Looking back, I realize how stupid that sounds. Rats don't walk like people. By the end of the first week, it was happening every night, always around 2 a.m., always the same pattern, 5 or 6 steps, then silence. I'd gotten into this ridiculous routine of lying perfectly still when it happened, as if whoever or whatever might hear me moving around. I should have said something sooner. On Saturday morning, I caught Mr. Pemberton as he was collecting rubbish from the bins out front. He's this elderly guy, maybe 70, always wearing the same brown cardigan. "Mr. Pemberton, hey, quick question. What's below my flat?" He looked at me like I'd asked him to explain quantum physics. "Below? Nothing, mate. Just foundation, concrete, and earth. It's just, I keep hearing footsteps At night, under the floor. His face did something weird then. Not quite a frown. Not quite a smile. Old building, he said. Sounds travel in funny ways. Probably the couple upstairs. At 2 a.m. every night? They work late shifts. He turned away, dragging the bin. You'll get used to it. But I didn't get used to it. The sounds got worse, heavier. Sometimes they'd stop right under my bed, and I'd feel, I know this sounds mental, but I'd feel like something was listening to me through the floorboards. My heart would pound so hard I thought I might actually have a heart attack. I'm not a paranoid person. I mean, I'd lived in London for 5 years. I'd dealt with dodgy landlords, weird flatmates, the whole lot. But this felt different. Something wasn't right. About 2 weeks in, I noticed the loose floorboard. It was next to my bed, near the radiator. When I stepped on it, it seesawed slightly, the nails having worked themselves free. I probably walked past it 100 times without really seeing it. It was a Thursday night. I'll never forget. And the footsteps had been particularly loud. So loud that I'd gotten up, turned on every light in the flat, and just stood there in my boxers, feeling ridiculous and terrified at the same time. That's when I saw the floorboard was slightly raised, like someone had pried it up and not quite pushed it back down properly. I should have called the police right then. Instead, I grabbed a screwdriver from my kitchen drawer and knelt down. The board came up easily, revealing a dark gap below. I turned on my phone's torch and pointed it into the hole. My heart dropped. There was a crawl space down there, maybe 3 feet high, extending into darkness. And directly below where I was kneeling, a sleeping bag, navy blue, the expensive kind. Next to it, a neat stack of food wrappers, Tesco sandwiches, crisps, energy bars, a plastic water bottle, and a torch, and photographs. My hands were shaking so badly, I nearly dropped my phone. I reached down and grabbed the photos, maybe 5 or 6 of them, printed on regular paper. They were all of me, sleeping, in my bed, taken from different angles, like someone had been moving around under the floorboards with a camera pressed to the gaps. In one photo, you could see my face clearly, eyes closed, mouth slightly open. The timestamp in the corner read, 2:47 a.m. 2 days ago. I felt sick, properly sick, like I might throw up right there. That's when I heard it. A scraping sound coming from the crawl space. Someone was down there, right now. I don't remember dropping the floorboard back down or running to my front door. I don't remember grabbing my coat or my keys. What I do remember is the sound of movement speeding up below me as I ran. Someone scrambling, trying to reach something. Trying to reach me. I was out the door, up the stairs to street level, into the cold October air. I called 999 while standing under a street lamp, shaking so hard I could barely hold the phone. The police came. They found the crawl space, the sleeping bag, the photos. They told me there was an old coal cellar access in the back garden, hidden behind overgrown bushes. Someone had been breaking in and living underneath me. They found more photos on an old digital camera down there. Weeks worth. Me eating breakfast. Me working at my laptop. Me sleeping. They never found who it was. No fingerprints, apparently. No DNA matches. Just the stuff they left behind. Mr. Pemberton swore he didn't know about the coal cellar. Maybe he didn't, maybe he did. I moved out that same night, crashed with my mate again, broke the lease, lost my deposit, but I didn't care. To this day, I still can't sleep in ground floor flats. I'm up in Finsbury Park now, 3rd floor, and I check under every rug, every loose board. I know it's not rational. I know the chances of it happening again are basically zero. But sometimes, late at night, when the building settles, I hold my breath and listen, just in case. Story 3. I've been driving lorries for 12 years now, mostly night shifts, on the M6 between Manchester and Glasgow. I'm telling you this because I need you to understand, I'm not some kid who spooks easily. I'm 43. I've seen plenty of weird stuff on these roads, and I know the difference between tired eyes and something actually being wrong. But what happened last Tuesday? I still can't explain it. It was about 3 a.m. when I pulled into that services near Carlisle. You know the type. Half the lights broken, one cashier behind bulletproof glass, and maybe two other vehicles in the entire car park. I'd been on the road since 8 the previous evening, and I was only stopping because regulations say I have to. That's when I saw him. He was standing under one of the working streetlights, thumb out, wearing a dark coat that looked too thin for November. Young lad, maybe early 20s, with a rucksack at his feet. I normally don't stop for hitches, company policy and all that, but something about him seemed desperate. Lost, maybe. I rolled down my window. Where you headed? North, he said. His voice was soft, polite. Anywhere north is fine. I should have known then. I mean, who doesn't have a specific destination? But I was tired, and honestly, I didn't fancy another 4 hours alone with just the radio. Hop in, mate. I'm going to Glasgow. I heard the passenger door open, felt the lorry shift slightly as he climbed in. The door closed with that solid thunk that 18-wheelers make. Cheers, he said, settling into the seat. I really appreciate it. We pulled back onto the M6, and for the first hour or so, we actually had a decent chat. He told me he'd been visiting family down south, that his girlfriend was waiting for him in Edinburgh. Normal stuff. His name was Tom, or maybe Tim. I honestly can't remember now, which bothers me more than it should. You do this run often? He asked. 4 times a week, usually. Been doing it for years. Don't you get lonely? I shrugged. You get used to it. Besides, I've got podcasts, audiobooks, keeps the mind busy. Looking back, I realize he never actually answered any personal questions. Every time I asked something specific, where exactly his girlfriend lived, what he did for work, he'd deflect, turn it back to me. But in the moment, I didn't notice. I was just glad for the company. About 2 hours in, something started feeling off. The cab had gotten cold. Not just chilly, properly cold, like when the heating cuts out completely. I fiddled with the controls, but they were working fine, showing 18 degrees. My breath wasn't fogging or anything, but I felt it. This deep cold that seemed to come from the passenger seat. You feel that? I asked. Feel what? The temperature. It's freezing. Feels all right to me, he said. Maybe I was just paranoid. Maybe the heating was dodgy. I turned it up higher and tried to focus on the road. That's when I noticed he hadn't moved. Not once. Not a scratch, not a shift in his seat. Nothing. Everyone fidgets, you know, especially on long drives. But Tom, Tim, whatever his name was, he sat perfectly still, hands folded in his lap, staring straight ahead. You all right there? I asked. Fine. Just tired. Want me to turn on some music? No, thank you. The conversation died after that. I tried a few more times to start it up again, but he'd just give short answers, and the silences between felt heavier each time. I started counting down the miles to the next services. I didn't want to seem rude, but something wasn't right. My instincts were screaming at me to stop, to get him out of my cab. We passed a sign, services 15 miles. I need to stop for fuel soon, I said. You can probably get a bus from there if you want to push on to Edinburgh. That would be good. 12 minutes later, I was watching the clock. I pulled into the services at Abington. The place was better lit than the last stop, and there were a few more vehicles around. I felt relief flood through me as I killed the engine. Right then, I said, unbuckling my seatbelt. I'll just be a few minutes. I glanced over at the passenger seat. It was empty. I felt my heart drop. The seatbelt was still fastened, hanging there, like he'd just vanished. The seat itself was pristine. No impression, no warmth, nothing. What the? I climbed out of the cab and walked around to the passenger side. The door was locked from the inside. I unlocked it manually and pulled it open. The door was stiff, like it hadn't been opened in a while. And there, across the handle, was a spider web. Intact, delicate, definitely not something that could survive someone opening and closing the door twice. My hands were shaking as I filled up with diesel. I kept looking around, expecting to see him walking away, some rational explanation. But the car park was nearly empty, and none of the few people around matched his description. I went inside to pay. The cashier was a middle-aged woman who looked as tired as I felt. "Did you see anyone get out of my lorry?" I asked her. "Young lad, dark coat?" She shook her head. "Been watching the cameras. You've been the only one at that pump." Could I see? She turned the monitor toward me. I watched myself pull in, get out, walk around the cab, check the passenger door. The whole time, through the windscreen, you could see clear as day. The passenger seat was empty. Had been empty the entire time. "You all right, love?" she asked. "You look like you've seen a ghost." I paid and left. I didn't tell her that's exactly what I thought I'd done. I drove the rest of the way to Glasgow in silence. No radio, no podcasts. Just me and the road and this growing certainty that I hadn't been alone in that cab. When I got to the depot, I checked the passenger seat properly. Nothing. No evidence anyone had ever been there. But the cab was still cold. And when I looked at the door frame, I noticed something that made my blood run cold. There were fingerprints on the inside of the window. Small, precise fingerprints. And they were frosted over, like they'd been made in ice. I'll never forget how real he seemed, the way he spoke, the way he answered my questions. I've driven that route 3 times since then, and I haven't stopped at that first services again. To this day, I still check the passenger seat compulsively, expecting to see someone sitting there in the darkness. Sometimes, late at night on empty stretches of the M6, I catch myself glancing over, just to make sure I'm really alone.